From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made last Wednesday, May 16th, when President Donald Trump hosted a roundtable meeting with several law enforcement leaders from California. They were discussing sanctuary laws and the challenge of enforcing immigration laws. Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims told the president that her department is restricted in how much it can share with federal immigration and customs enforcement agents, known as ICE. She referenced an international criminal operation known as MS-13, and she said it's a disgrace that her deputies can't do more to stop them. President Trump responded by saying that the people committing these crimes are less than human. They're animals, the president said. This set off a bit of a firestorm. Some media outlets reported that Trump made the remarks about all undocumented immigrants, when it was pretty clear, at least to me, that he was speaking directly about MS-13. But as I watched that debate unfold, something else occurred to me. Why do we talk about anybody as animals? Why do we dehumanize anyone? Now, please, before you email me to remind me that technically human beings are animals, too, please understand the issue we're talking about. The issue is language that intentionally dehumanizes others, categorizes them as unredeemable, or fails to understand why some people become violent in the first place. I heard from a number of people who said that we have to draw a line somewhere. Members of MS-13 have committed some grisly, unthinkable crimes. And some critics told me to draw the line there, that we have to use strong language to describe them. And all of that convinced me we should have a lengthier discussion on dehumanization, slippery slopes, and how we talk about one another. Now, you know my own bias coming into this hour, and I wanted you to know that because I was on Twitter discussing it last week. But I am here with an open mind, and one of the critics who pushed back against me is a somewhat frequent guest of the program. Paul Simonelli is managing partner with Simonelli & Simonelli in Rochester, and kind enough with his time to be back here today. Thanks for being here, Paul.
Glad to be here, Evan.
And Kit Miller is director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence in Rochester. Kit, always nice to have you as well. Thanks for being back here.
Thank you, Evan.
Now, let's listen to full context here, because I will at least say that I think the mainstream media, and I don't mean to sort of sound like media critics or whatever, but I do think the media sort of got this one a little bit wrong at first, maybe understandably so. We can talk about that, because the president has used dehumanizing language about undocumented immigrants in the past. But in this case, let's listen to part of that roundtable in which you had Sheriff Mims from Fresno County, California, and this was the president responding to some of her initial remarks. Then you'll hear another exchange. You'll get a sense for what they were talking about.
Now ICE is the only law enforcement agency that cannot use our databases to find the bad guys. They cannot come in and talk to people in our jail unless they reach a certain threshold. They can't do all kinds of things that other law enforcement agencies can do. And it's really put us in
a
very
disgrace.
Bad position. It's a disgrace.
And we're suing on that, and we're working hard, and I think it'll all come together. Because people want it to come together. It's so ridiculous. The concept that we're even talking about it is so ridiculous. We'll take care of it, Margaret.
Thank you. There could be an MS-13 gang member I know about. If they don't reach a certain threshold, I cannot tell ICE about them.
Yeah. We have people coming into the country, or trying to come in. We're stopping a lot of them. But we're taking people out of the country. You wouldn't believe how bad these people are. These aren't people. These are animals. And we're taking them out of the country at a level and at a rate that's never happened before. And because of the weak laws, they come in fast. We get them, we release them, we get them again, we bring them out. It's crazy. The dumbest laws, as I said before, the dumbest laws on immigration in the world. So we're going to take care of it, Margaret. We'll get it done.
That's President Trump talking to Fresno County Sheriff Margaret Mims. I'll start with Paul Simonelli. What do you make of the exchange, Paul?
I think what he was saying was obvious. He was limiting himself to not only MS-13, but MS-13 that had obviously done something to get kicked out of the country and came back again. I mean, so if we take with what he said.
I don't disagree with that. I think in this case, that's right. But let me ask you about the choice of language there. When he says these aren't humans, these are animals. What do you think?
I think that dehumanizing language in a specific content against an individual action or an individual that has done something is not the same as dehumanizing an entire group like all of the Jews during Nazi Germany's reign or any other large group that we may consider.
And do you think it's appropriate to talk about, because for listeners who don't know MS-13, there have been some really ghastly, not just murders, but mutilizations and attacks on all kinds of different communities. Do you think that kind of language is appropriate for people who've committed those crimes?
I think within a certain context, it may be appropriate to communicate the extent of what they've done. Once again, when we're talking about a very specific individual or a specific series of events that an individual or small group may be responsible for.
Okay. Kit Miller, what do you make of the exchange you heard?
I'm feeling thoughtful hearing about it, of course. And but my issue is the leadership. Any time that someone in leadership uses language that dehumanizes, even if it's in a very specific context, I think it opens up the floodgates of permission to use it in other ways. So given the role that the man has right now in our country, I think it's a dangerous frame to use to speak about anybody. If he was a private citizen and he wanted to speak that way, that would be another thing, but he's not.
I want to ask our listeners as we go throughout the hour to reflect and let us know what you think about not only what you heard from the president, but also just the way we do talk about other people and whether in this context, is it okay to use that kind of language or does it, as Kit said, open up the door to expand that? It's 844-295-TALK. It's toll free. 844-295-8255 or 263-WXXI if you're in Rochester. 263-9994. Paul, do you... So some of the conversation about anybody who ends up, whether it's MS-13, a gang in Rochester, someone who's left school and is pursuing, at least at the moment, a life that involves crime, sometimes we talk about what starts a person down that road. And most of the time, there's some kind of trauma or difficulty in their own life. Very few people, I think, of privilege end up in MS-13, though I'm certainly open to being disabused of that notion if I'm factually wrong about that. Do you care about someone's history, about when we talk about the criminal acts that they have committed, what led them to these cases? Does that matter to you? Are you interested?
I would have to say that I'm always interested. I mean, as a former prosecutor, I need to understand what people, why they may have done what they've done. But once again, that's just... I don't know that that's a necessity to know that. You know, we talk about the level of education, and you corrected yourself. Most of the bombers on 9/11 were college or master's degree prepared folks.
No, that's fair. That's fair.
Once again, people make choices, and you know, I teach about terrorism, and there's no way to figure out who's going to be a terrorist. No one's come up with a magic formula. It ultimately comes down to choice. And yes, there are factors that when we look at things after the fact that we can say, well, yes, this person, you know, this happened to a family member or something else, but that's not always the case. And so once again, it does come down to personal choice when people do things.
Okay, yeah, and I think to Paul's point on terrorism, pointing to 9/11, the 19, I think, hijackers, for example, that is an important point. It's probably... There's some finer distinctions between, I think, probably something like an MS-13 versus terrorists that has ostensible religious roots to it, but that's probably a separate discussion. I take the point. And I'm also curious to know if Kit, do you find that background relevant? Do you think we should be interested in personal lives of people who end up in, whether it's MS-13 or otherwise?
Two thoughts. One is that the precursor to being able to do violence to another person is our ability to dehumanize them in our mind, in our thoughts. So anytime that that's modeled, for me, it creates a dangerous precedent. Whether a teacher does it in front of students, a parent in front of their children, it's a way that we make the world less safe through letting, our language set that tone. So again, with someone who has as much rank and authority as the president, using the language in that way, I think it's a very, very dangerous precedent. I think that understanding the backstory of all violence is critical for us to deal with it in a root cause way. We tend to, get all blown around by the events that are happening in the world, but I'm really interested in systems thinking and looking deeper, So what are the structures that are informing and creating this particular group of human beings? Like, rather than reacting and responding to what they're doing, I want to know what got them there in the first place, and how can that be changed or dismantled? Because violence begets violence.
And so, Kit, let me follow up with one point on Kit, and I know Paul wants to jump in here too. And let me kind of work through some of where my mind goes when we talk about these root causes. Because what Paul is pointing out is that we can't always know, and we can't always just assume that someone who ends up in violence, whether it's terrorism, whether it's international gang activity or otherwise, has had X set of circumstances. It's a little more complex than that. I can recall back in my commercial television news reporting days where I would walk through the Hall of Justice, and I would see, you know, usually a man on trial, often a man of color, and I would see young children, and I would see, and now having a six-year-old, I'm really acutely aware of just what I think I would love for kids to experience, and what I would see in the eyes of these three-year-olds, these four-year-olds, these beautiful young children, was just this vacant look, this confusion. And I was looking at these kids going, God, these kids are so beautiful. What does their future hold? And will someday, is it possible that they could be an adult and we could be dismissing them as, well, that, use your pejorative term, that animal, that this, that that, without asking? That was a beautiful three-year-old child at one point in their life who just didn't understand why they were being dragged through a hall of justice or in different circumstances. That's why, to me, the root cause does matter. But what Paul is reminding us is that it's not always the case like that. So there are many cases where someone in an affluent life ends up in violence. So is it dangerous to over-assume that someone who is violent has experienced trauma?
I don't think it's dangerous to assume that a lot of people have trauma at this stage in the world. You know, just it's not the world that many, many people would want to have. And the existential issues that we have in front of us are considerable. You know, there's more than twice as many people on this planet since the year I was born. You know, we have an increasingly eroding natural resource base. There's a lot of sort of underlying factors that increase the level of anxiety, stress, and fear, which often brings out, frankly, the worst in people. And so how are we going to respond to that in a thoughtful way, in a non-reactive way, is, I think, one of the most important things that we can do to protect our civil society. I don't want my kids and your kids, or anyone who's listening, kids and grandkids, to live in a police state. I don't want us to live in a place where, you know, there's such a growing discrepancy of the haves and have-nots. That's not the future that I want to have for any child alive in the world. And if we continue to kind of, like, you know, set up the destruction intergenerationally in the way that we have been, and we are, I'm afraid that's where we're headed. So I think we have to, at some point, say no. You know, at some point, we're going to have to say, I'm not going to respond to violence with this kind of violence. Protective use of force, absolutely. Absolutely. Some people, it's not safe for them to be on the streets. It's not safe for them. It's not safe for other people. I'm not, you know, saying that that's not true. But opening up, you know, for the kind of dehumanizing language is a problem. I'm thinking of a young student from the University of Rochester who just graduated this week, on Ian Manzi. And he was born in Rwanda, like just within a year after the genocide occurred there. And he's taught me a lot about just what were the conditions that created the potential for genocide in Rwanda. And so much of it had to do with the language that was used and the way that the media kind of used dehumanizing images. So I think it's a critical thing. It's a critical thing for us to look at, and especially when people with a lot of structural power use dehumanizing language, I think it's a very, very concerning thing.
All right, Bill in Waterloo, Tom in Rochester, we're coming to you on the phone in just a moment. Paul Simonelli, a lot to respond there. Go ahead.
Right. I just want to go back to one of the first things you said. I agree what leaders say matter dramatically, tremendously to people will key off of that. So I agree with you. But just again, to draw a counterpoint, right after 9/11, and I don't know if we all remember what President Bush called the folks that the terrorists that were involved in 9/11. And in his speech, first speech after that, he called them evildoers. And the mainstream media jumped on him, saying he was anti-Muslim because that evildoer term came out of the Bible. You know, he didn't call them animals. He didn't call them, he didn't dehumanize them. He called them evildoers. And so even that was attacked as being, because it was a biblical reference, that it was anti-Muslim. And of course, other people were saying that wasn't a strong enough term to say about these people that were involved in 9/11. So you mentioned about the media's role in all this, and I think that has a lot to do with it. The media did characterize incorrectly, and I can't say anything but purposefully what was said by President Trump. And I'll be the first one to tell you there's many things that he says that I think he could have said it in a much better way. And just with some of the other points you're making, I'm not going to disagree with you on anything. I spent most of my military career in countries dealing with the people in those countries and understanding. My job was to gain understanding so that the military would be better equipped to do what they had to do without having to get to the point of violence. So I spent a lot of time and energy trying to understand what the underlying reasons for circumstances were, and there's many as there are people, so it's very hard to generalize about anything when it's a very specific to individuals. And the one thing that those individuals do have, and I'll keep going back to it, is choice about whether they do things. And when they lower themselves to a certain level through their conduct, many times dehumanizing words are used to describe that conduct. It might be out of ignorance or otherwise, but sometimes it's very difficult to communicate, whether you're a leader or not, just the extent of what these, what people have done. And when you've seen it firsthand, it becomes completely understandable, if nothing else.
Now, do you agree with Kit's contention that when we use language that dehumanizes anyone, even if we are going to grant that he was talking about the most violent MS-13 members, even if we are just using dehumanizing language for anybody, does that sort of send the message that some human beings are less than human? And does that create a culture that says you're going to go through life and some people will be less than, and that opens the door for either discriminating or physical violence?
No, that's a compound question. So what I'll say is, if a person has done something, if they've acted in a manner that is beyond what normal humans are willing or capable to do, then I really don't have a problem with it. When I was a prosecutor, I remember in one case that I called someone a cancer, that had been involved in numerous homicides and numerous crimes around this community. It really was. It was a reign of terror that he had perpetrated on this community, and I called him a cancer in the closing argument, and the defense attorney objected to it, and the judge let me finish my closing argument. In hindsight, 25 years ago when I did that, could I have picked a better word? I couldn't, sitting there and living with this case for almost a year before I tried it, I really couldn't find a better way to describe the effect this person had had on the community. Was that dehumanizing? It may have been, but it was very targeted and specific, and the jury had sat through a two-week trial hearing about what this person had done time and
multiple
time and time
acts
again.
Of violence?
Yes. All violent crimes in this community, yes.
Okay, so Kit Miller, why is someone who has done those kinds of crimes, I assume you would object to the term that person is a cancer. Would you object to that? And if so, why?
I can imagine, especially when you're passionately making your point in front of a jury, I could imagine saying, owning it as an evaluation that you would have to say, when I think about this person at this point, I liken them to a cancer. So I can imagine that if you were owning it as your own evaluation, then, I think it's important that we be able to speak our hearts. But for me, it's different to say I think of this person as a cancer because of the deep, rather than saying someone is something. It's a different impact. So I think the way that we use language matters. It's how we make meaning inside of ourselves. It's how we make meaning between ourselves. And to say that the way that we use language doesn't matter, I think is very specious. It's the only way we have of getting our understanding across with each other. So I think it matters how we talk to each other. I think it's critical.
This is why I think it's interesting going back, and please, right after our only break of the hour, we're going to come right to your phone call. So please hang there. Thank you for calling. To Paul's point about President Bush, there's something interesting that strikes me. I hadn't thought about the whole evildoers thing in a long time. To call someone an evildoer is not quite the same, at least in my mind. It doesn't land the same way as saying they are evil. And sometimes we have this debate about, well, is there evil in the world? I think there are acts that are evil, but I don't know. Do you think people are evil, Paul?
I do. And
see, that's where the difference is. The president wasn't saying, you know, we're going to go after evil people. We're going to go, though he might have said something like that. But to say someone has done an act of evil is different than saying that person is evil. In the same order to what Kit is saying, when I think about their actions, it reminds me of a cancer, saying that person is a cancer. And when you affix that label, that takes them beyond redemption. Now, maybe in your mind, there becomes a line where there is no redemption possible.
And that ultimately, and they may have some redemption with their maker, but as long as being part of society, civil society, there are people that are not redeemable. And we've seen them all through history. Criminals and other folks that have done things that there is no redemption.
They are evil in your mind.
That are evil, right? I've just seen too much. I've seen it on the streets with certain criminals. Not every criminal. I've seen many criminals that have redeemed themselves, and have done well and have lived wonderful lives and have been contributed to society. But there are a small number of people that. At least in this world, don't appear to be redeemable, and the risk of trying to do that far exceeds, I think, any gain that we're going to, that we might achieve from doing that. So, yeah, there is evil in the world. I saw pure evil. You know, I've got to tell you, I can give you examples, and that I've lived through, and I've seen firsthand, and there's just no. There are people that just cannot be.
They are evil, you think?
Yes, without a doubt.
So obviously, murder, ending someone's life, is going to fall in that category for you. But let's take the example of someone.
Well, maybe not even one murder. Someone who.
Let's say someone who assaults elderly people as they walk across the street and take their money, and they end up caught assaulting people, and they're going to prison. But it's not a life sentence.
Right.
Are they redeemable? Are they evil?
At that moment, they are evil. And are they redeemable?
Or are
yes.
they doing acts of evil? Do we need to open the door to saying, you're going to be back in society. I'm not going to describe you as evil. I'm going to say what you've done might have been evil. But we're going to work with you to change that. Or are they a fixed term? That person is evil.
Well, maybe I should draw an analogy. If someone's an alcoholic, they might be a non-drinking alcoholic. They might be a recovered alcoholic. But they are always an alcoholic. So a person who has done some evil to that extent, and what I was going to say, you were going less than killing. I was going to say someone who killed hundreds of people.
Sure, no, but I think we have to take it that way because that's the slippery slope that I hear someone like Kit saying is, if you can feel that someone's unredeemable for some of the crimes of MS-13, I understand. But if someone knocks down an elderly woman crossing the street, steals her belongings, goes to prison, and is going to be back in society. If that person is irredeemable, then we're in trouble when people who are currently incarcerated become not incarcerated.
Correct. And so, I mean, it might be semantics, but while they're performing those evil acts, they are evil. And are they redeemable? Most are, if they choose to be redeemed.
So it goes back to personal choice for you.
Yes.
Okay. Kit?
I appreciate this conversation. I'm thinking about Howard Thurman, who's one of my big heroes. He was a friend of Martin Luther King Sr.'s and a mentor at times to King himself. And Thurman spoke about the danger of when hatred becomes respectable in a society, the danger to of when hatred becomes respectable in a society. And he was speaking about that just after World War II, when he saw the hatred that was unleashed during the war, especially against Japanese people, which we knew, you know, led to the internment and concentration camps in this country for Japanese people, the prejudice against German people. And he wrote about the increased prejudice that he, as a man of color, also experienced during the war. He said it was like hatred got unleashed in the society. And when that happens, it's a very dangerous thing when hatred becomes respectable. And so many of the things that we're talking about right now, like this kind of like language from a leader, the way that what technology actually helps us to really be alienated from each other, all of that for me speaks to the danger of rising hatred in a society.
Like normalizing it?
It's normal. Like, you know, like the number, I mean, I'm sure you've read the hours that young people spend now playing games. And most of them are like learning how to shoot and blow things up. So we're training people to think that violence is fun, that it's pleasurable, that it's inevitable.
Or how about that when we talk about dehumanizing language, it becomes even easier, even in political debates. Oh, you have a neighbor? I like that neighbor until I found out that neighbor is a Republican or a Democrat. And all of a sudden, well, that neighbor is just an idiot or an animal. That's the concern that I feel, is that it's really easy to think of people as less than human if they even just disagree with us.
Absolutely. And again, you know, part of it relates to that we conduct more and more of our relationships via technology. There's a lot of research around how technology allows us to dehumanize from each other. So I'm just looking at it as like all these emerging things occurring in our society simultaneously. And so there's no such thing as a small act these days, in my opinion, especially when you're someone who commands the media attention that a president does.
All right. So one more question for both of our guests, then we'll go to your phone calls. Kit, I'll start with you on this. Do you in your heart feel like you hate anyone?
For a long time, I struggled with a principal of my school that was incredibly mean to me when my father died. And then for a long time, the doctor that was involved in my daughter's death. I'm still struggling with her. But I think that's it right now.
Paul.
I don't know that I've ever hated any individual. Have I had hateful thoughts? Sure.
By the way, I should clarify too, because Kit made this about sort of personal experience.
Right.
Can you feel hateful toward groups of terrorists, mass murderers? Do you hate?
No. No.
No?
No.
MS-13?
No. Hate is a pretty extreme thing. And I think without some personal connection, it's hits close to home, like like you've just discussed, such an extremely painful thing for me. I don't know that I'm capable of hating.
Okay.
I mean, maybe it had to do with the way I was raised and the example of my parents. I still think that probably had more to do with it than anything else. It was the environment I was raised in, and how I saw my parents interact with people that did bad things towards them. I think that was probably what set the tone for me. No, I can't say that I sit here. I've seen hateful acts. I've thought about hateful acts of doing them myself, but I can't say that there's a person that I hate.
Okay, but even groups of people
even
who commit
never
crimes.
Groups.
Okay.
Never groups.
Okay.
No.
Okay. Kit.
Sometimes when I hear about people with a lot of structural power who are making choices that seem to be conscious, I struggle. I definitely do. So I think that's one of the reasons why I've done workshops in looking at issue of hatred. We've done workshops at the Institute called Let's Talk About Hate. Because one of the things that Thurman writes about in his powerful book, Jesus and the Disinherited, which I highly recommend. It was a book that Dr. King carried around during the intensity of the civil rights era. Thurman said that, you know, we've done a very inadequate job, especially he was writing as a Christian minister, so he's writing in Christian context. But he says we do a very inadequate job of looking at hate squarely in the eye, owning it as an emotion that runs through every human heart, so that all we do is turn our faces away and we condemn people who we describe as hateful for whatever set of reasons. So for me, I think it's very powerful and important, again, to just like look at, and look at the mirror and say, I contain all of these possibilities myself. And knowing that helps me to be even more steadfast and standing up and saying things like, you know, no language is excusable when we're dehumanizing people, because I know how dangerous it can be.
Okay. Yeah, Paul?
I would just in what it would, to me, it would seem a stronger language to say I hate than to call someone an animal. I think hate is the ultimate emotion. And so if you ever hear me say that, it's going to be to the nth degree higher than me calling, you know, this criminal a cancer or dehumanizing an individual or a small group for what they're doing. So once again, I think many times it's just a descriptive use of words, and I know words do matter, but it gets the message across at times.
Okay. You're hearing Paul Simonelli, who's a managing partner with Simonelli & Simonelli Law Firm in Rochester, and Kit Miller, director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence. And let's go to your phone calls. I'm going to start with Bill in Waterloo, who's been waiting. Bill, thank you. Go ahead.
Thanks. This conversation got a whole lot deeper than when what my original point was. But earlier I was going to say that I think what's missing a lot of times in leadership, and especially probably with the president, is a general lack of professionalism when you're a leader. And it seems to be a skill to be able to communicate effectively and to describe your feelings without using words that, you know, would be dehumanizing. And it also, Evan, like you mentioned earlier, how subjective is this? You know, if you like the person, you know, like when you mentioned the evildoers, mm-hmm. you know, part of that, I know Bush wasn't very popular, was part of that because he wasn't a popular person, and now, you know, Trump's not very popular. How much subjectivity
yeah.
is placed on the wording? This is a really, really interesting conversation, and I'm glad it's gone to the depths that you are, and I'm really sitting here enjoying it. So I didn't mind being on hold because I liked the conversation.
Yeah. Bill, thank you. I appreciate that. Are you able to listen on Finger Lakes Public Radio or otherwise?
Yeah, we are.
Okay. All right. Well, I'm going to let you go then, Bill, and thank you for that. I really appreciate the phone call.
Thanks.
And thanks for listening on WEOS Finger Lakes Public Radio, all the way down to Ithaca and beyond there, 89.5 FM down there. And our thanks to Greg and Kelly and the wonderful team and our colleagues down there. So I want to ask our guest a little bit of what Bill just talked about, but I do think the whole subjectivity of, well, he said this, you know, it is interesting to me when President Trump says something that people sort of tweak about, and then you can find an instance where President Obama said the same thing, and usually progressives will sort of just ignore that. They don't retweet that. But I take Bill's point. There's a lot of subjectivity in how we analyze this. You know, Paul, you've been railing against the media coverage last week, which I think, by the way, is a fair critique. I think the media overbroadly looked at that particular instance. The problem that a lot of progressives would come back to you with is, well, this would be easier to believe that Trump was talking about one small group if he hadn't, on his campaign launch day, talked about Mexicans as some are good people, but, you know, rapists. You know, that there is a history of language that dehumanizes, and that unfortunately is sort of part and parcel with the package they see. So take it however you want from Bill's comments there. Go ahead.
I think we know what we have with Trump, President Trump. I think we knew what we had with President Obama and President Bush before him. And I think it's much ado about nothing. You deal with different people. I had a commander that used the F word every other word. When growing up, we did not use any bad language in my home. I mean, if we said the word screw and didn't have a toolbox in our hand, there was a bar of soap coming out. So, you know, when I got into the Army and started hearing the language that was being used on a daily basis, and I found myself, because maybe of ignorance or my inability to communicate with my soldiers, using that language. I said, well, I'm a smart college-educated person. I'm going to talk to them. And sometimes I did use that language to get a point across in a moment, to get things done in a hurry, to show a sense of urgency. It was based on the circumstance and the situation. And, you know, do I wish I would have been able to communicate in a different way? Sure. But so once again, I'm
But that's not the same, is it?
No, but what I'm saying is when we're talking about a specific circumstance or individual, and in a perfect world, would it be better if we didn't use dehumanize ever? Sure. But I think it can be an effective tool given the circumstances that people may be in a certain situation.
Yeah, I'm reading Deb's note here, and so where I see a point of disagreement, and I'm going to try to represent their views faithfully, is that Paul sees dehumanizing language as for really specific cases that when applied in Paul's views are sort of justifiable cases, MS-13, a mass murder, et cetera, is targeted, specific, and not in danger of spreading or sparking views of dehumanization society-wide. That he thinks it's contained, that it is sometimes appropriate, et cetera. Whereas Kit Miller's concern is that the more we talk in dehumanizing ways about anybody, the more we're likely to do it outside of that initial group, for lack of a better word. And then what do we have? Well, Deb writes to us and says, I agree that language is important, that we must separate the language regarding behavior from that describing the state of being. In Germany in the 1930s, there was a concerted effort made to subconsciously change the associations with gypsies, gays, and Jews by using language that dehumanized. If someone is not human, i.e. subhuman, we do not need to worry about how poorly we treat them. This is a slippery slope that we are on because of the current administration's disrespect for and ignorance of language and its power both to build up and also to tear down. Paul, thoughts on that, and then Kit as well.
Well, I would say, just to draw a comparison, I think, and you know, this is not the discussion of the day, but I see organizations dehumanizing on a regular basis in this country when they talk about fetuses rather than human life. So it seems that a moment before birth, it's a fetus. At the moment of birth, it's a human life. And even though it is a viable, separate part of a person. And so we've done it. And, you know, we can talk about Trump, you know, President Trump, we can talk about dehumanizing entire, but dehumanization of fetuses is, you know, leads to 3 million abortions a year in part. So, I mean, that's a discussion for a different day, but I think we have to be very careful that if it's convenient for us to do it and it fits with our model of what society should be and how we should live our lives, then it seems like it's perfectly okay in this country. And, you know, we're talking about the president talking about a very specific group of people that have proven themselves to act in manner that is, in many ways, not any way that a rational human being can even comprehend.
Okay. Just to be clear, are you okay with dehumanization of fetuses?
No, not at all.
But you're okay with dehumanization language for subgroups of people as long as they've committed acts that you think are in that category?
Yes.
Okay. Kit. No, I just wanted to clarify. I appreciate the clarification. Go ahead, Kit.
Yeah, I'm still with the question about media.
Yeah.
And the idea that the president is unaware of the impact of his language, I question that. I think that this is a skillful awareness that most media organizations are, what they measure now is like the number of hits on their story or their website, or it's commercially based. And so saying and doing outrageous things and reporting on it is a business. And these are the outcomes that we're getting. So I disagree with the note. I think it's a dangerous thing to just assume that President Trump is unaware of the choices that he's making and the impact. I'd also like to hold the media more accountable around what they choose to report or the depth, the way that we talk about things. I think we need a much deeper discourse on all these topics. Just rushing from one headline to the next, one event to the next. One of the things that Martin Luther King said is that, you know, our human tendency is to put 80% of our attention on what people say or do and 20% on the underlying issues, and that's actually a way to make sure that the status quo remains in place. That the way that we could really change things in a deeper way is to flip that discourse. 80% of our attention ought to be on what's the underlying issue? What is the underlying issue that this thing represents? Not what he said, she said, what the context was. So for me, I mean, that's why my interest is in the deeper systems look at every single thing that's happening. Because again, what we're creating today, what we're doing today, is the future that we're pulling towards us for the kids, and we have to be responsible for that.
All right, let me get back to your phone calls, and this is Tom in Rochester next. Go ahead, Tom.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call. I agree with the last comment by your panelist, and I think you're giving President Trump too much benefit of the doubt. I think that, unfortunately, I think he's proven himself to be kind of a racist and a hypocrite. And I say that based on his previous comments. You mentioned one of them during the campaign when he was talking about Mexicans coming to this country. He made another comment about people from Haiti and other countries who are trying to come here. And I think he's proven himself to, you know, those are his true colors. And I think you're giving him too much benefit of the doubt to just single out this comment and parse it as much as you have, although the discussion is fascinating. And then my final point is that I think it's hypocritical to single out immigrants and people of color and ignore the violence and acts that are happening, that are being perpetrated by Americans and by people who take up guns and go and shoot up a church or a movie theater, and it's just very sad. And thank you for taking my call.
Thank you, Tom. So a couple of points there, and then I'll kick it over to our guests. I take Tom's point on the broader sort of record that the president has, but all I did last week was I heard the full clip, and then someone said, "What do you think he was talking about?" I said, "I think he was talking about MS-13. It was pretty obvious. The sheriff from Fresno County brought up MS-13, and Trump made the comment about some people are animals. But I understand why someone like Tom would say he can link it to the record, which goes beyond just this one. I just, you know, as the host of this program, I'm telling you honestly, I heard that comment. I thought he was just talking about MS-13. So I take Tom's point. And Paul, you know, he's looking at the broader record, saying that there's enough that he views as racist that sets a really dehumanizing and problematic tone.
Go ahead. Sure. 2 points. I agree with Kit that I don't underestimate Trump for President Trump for a minute. I think everything that comes out of his mouth, he has some reason why he's doing it. So I'll agree with you on that. And maybe it's beyond my comprehension or your comprehension. Second thing is about we don't spend enough time discussing. Your show is an anomaly. WXXI allows, you know, the format allows you the time to have this extended format, and it would be wonderful if there were other opportunities to do this and people afforded themselves those opportunities. As it relates to, now I forgot the third point I wanted to make about the phone call.
You and Rick Perry.
No, I know what I wanted to say is that, once again, I think if you go back to those quotes that they're talking about, Mexicans or other things, if you took it in the context of the entire conversation, he was talking about illegal immigration. And so because he didn't preface the word Mexican with illegally or individuals of Mexican descent illegally entering the country and committing crimes. But once again, if you took the whole context of that conversation, it was obvious. Did he do it in an artful way? Sure. I'll be the first one to say so, but I just don't see through his words. And I've got to tell you, if you look through many of his actions and things that he's done, once again, to label someone a racist, you know, we're talking about labeling someone subhuman. I think we're too quick to label people. I don't think we look far enough into the entire person.
You're the guy who said earlier, though, you can label some people as evil.
Sure, sure.
But you can label someone as evil, but then you turn around and say, we're too quick to label people.
No, I'm talking about when it's used. Listen,
you're using terms like racist.
Yes.
Then because to you, it seems like we're tarring someone unfairly.
Possibly.
Okay.
Possibly. I'm talking about, you know, an MS-13 member that has raped, killed, decapitated. And we know that.
Yeah,
or a terrorist that has done the same. Or, someone responsible for a mass grave site in Bosnia where there's 27 bodies, and they all were summarily executed in front of their families. That is subhuman. So once again, it is a slippery slope when we start talking about labeling people, and when we talk about the racist card or misogynist, or you name it right now. I think that's a little bit of a different discussion, but I don't. As I sit here, I will tell you, I've never met Donald Trump, most famous people I haven't met. But I would, as I'm sitting here right now, I would say if I had to evaluate whether he was a racist or not, I would say not. Because when I think of a racist, I think once again of the very extreme individual that, you know, we've seen at some places throughout our history.
What's an example? Because I think this is instructive. Like, what's the bar that you would think, okay, that person looks
David
like
Dukes.
David Duke. Okay. Okay. Kit.
Oh, how juicy. I'm so glad we have 3 more hours on the air.
No, we have about 5 minutes. Right?
I'm aware.
I know, she's being cheeky.
Well, it's nice to meet you because I'm a racist. Because I don't think that you can be a white person in a society like this one that has as much structural racism in it as ours and not be imbued with racism. And I've actually had the privilege of going to some of the faith communities in the area and speaking about trying to recover from racism, trying to recover from being seeped in the notion that because I'm white, that somehow I deserve something better and different and structurally in the world, which is, and all the outcomes, especially in this community, still point to the persistence of structural racism from everything from, you know, infant mortality to educational outcomes. ACT Rochester site has a fabulous, wealth of data on this topic. So I think it's every white person in the United States is inherently a racist because we were brought up to see ourselves in a certain way. And I certainly don't exempt President Trump from that. Some people are more active in terms of their efforts in that, and I would call him a very active person. But for me, we talk a lot about the violence today. We talk about mass killings or shootings, and I'm always interested in the kinds of structural violence that take place that's actually a much bigger killer. What the lack of effort that was made with the AIDS epidemic in the 70s and 80s in New York City killed 80,000 people, 80,000 New York City residents. We could have stopped, possibly the global spread, but we didn't because of there's all sorts of structural issues that go on all the time, and I'd love some time to talk about structural violence here because we always put violence as an act of an individual or a group, and there's a tremendous amount of violence that goes on silently through systems.
You brought this up with 5 minutes to go, Kit.
I know. Well, Paul, told me. I thought I had 3 hours.
Yeah. and now, unfortunately, if you're on the phone, I'm not going to be able to get back to you because I've got to let Paul respond to some of that, because what Paul said was he doesn't think the president's a racist. He's got a different bar for it. Kit's saying she believes she herself is a racist. I suspect you think Kit is not a racist, but do you hear the point that she's making? Is there any part of you that says she's making a good point about systemic advantage?
I don't agree about systemic advantage, but I do agree that everybody has tendencies. And once again, it's how they deal with those tendencies. We all have things that we like and dislike based on our perception, our perspective, how we were raised, our experiences we've had in life. And might that rise to racism? With some people, yes. But because it goes back to how people deal with it. Everybody has to deal with whatever history they have. And I don't think everyone is. If everyone's a racist, then no one's a racist. If everybody's
committed. She didn't say everyone's a racist.
Well,
white people in this country,
right,
in a country that has a systematic advantage, that you are born into and trained and sort of socialized into thinking that that is normal and just, when the advantages, in her view, are unjust.
And fair. I could find this is a discussion for another day.
Unfortunately, but, it is.
Yeah, I could find where there might be systemic advantages given to minorities on a regular basis, and we don't see those, and that could be a form of racism. You know, where you have certain classes of people get, you know, allowed or entering schools with lower grades than other
affirmative
folks.
Affirmative action,
where, you know, you have an Asian student that does 250 points better on the SATs, but don't, you know, they don't get into Harvard. Or, you know, schools choose, you know, when I applied to law schools, I was living in the South and I used my Southern address on all the Northern schools I applied to. And I figured that would give me some advantage because they'd want geographic dispersion. So if I was on the you know, if it was in the middle, if they weren't sure if they were going to take me or not, if I was just going to be another New Yorker trying to go to law school in a heavily New York school. So that
Paul's right. We need another whole other day for this.
Right.
Last thoughts, Kit. Go ahead.
I've appreciated how wide-ranging this conversation is. It points to the need for depth in our thinking as well as in our conversations.
Very generous of you. And Paul, final thoughts.
This has been, once again, another great conversation, and we need to do more in-depth conversations about many of these issues.
Yeah, I appreciate that. That's Paul Simonelli, who is managing partner with Simonelli and Simonelli Law Firm in Rochester, and Kit Miller, director of the Gandhi Institute for Nonviolence, also in Rochester. And both of them are always generous with their time and with each other, where they agree and disagree. There's some moments of agreement that they found and plenty of disagreement, but we're going to continue to work through this. Thanks to both of you for being here. Paul, thank you very much. Appreciate
it. Thank you.
Kit, thank you.
Thank you,
Evan. As always. Short break, more connections coming up.